Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If this is your first time listening in, welcome. We're so happy to have you join us. Our mission here is really simple, to improve companies and improve careers through continuous improvement. So we're here to share inspiring stories and journeys from individuals who have embarked on the path of continuous improvement. Through these interviews with leaders and innovators and change makers, we explore the sparks that ignite transformative journeys, both within organizations and in personal and career growth. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your improvement efforts to the next level, this podcast is here to help guide, inspire, and empower you. And I am your host, Keith Norris, and our guest today is Matt Kroll. Matt is a Lean Six Sigma Master Black Belt and operational excellence leader who's driven transformational change across healthcare, pharma, manufacturing. His deep experience in strategy execution and cultural change, Matt brings a practical lens to building high-performing organizations where continuous improvement actually sticks. Welcome, Matt. So happy to have you.
Thanks, Keith. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we like to start our podcast with a question. I call this the spark, but I find that a lot of folks have kind of maybe an interesting journey or a certain moment that they remember about their own like spark or that little moment where the light bulb went on and you thought, you know what, this might actually be my career. So I'm curious if there's a moment or like maybe a first introduction that you remember.
Yeah, that's great. Actually, that makes me actually think a little bit about back in college, because I started my college career as a mechanical engineer. I always knew I liked how things came together, how things get built. But I did find my mechanical engineering curriculum, I don't know, some of it was dry. I don't know how else to say it. And I looked at industrial engineering, and that's where you really see where people and process and systems come together to produce something, produce a product, and how you organize that. And that that was it for me, frankly. And then when I started at Motorola coming out of college, I learned about this Six Sigma that really took all the things that I had learned as an industrial engineer and put it into a problem-solving system so you can make those systems better. And so that was really it for me. I've always found the idea of improvement to be compelling. And so having the tools with that was what clicked for me.
That's awesome. Starting out in mechanical engineering, kind of getting a taste for the Six Sigma side of things. Tell us a little bit about your current company. It's the Chalmers Group, right?
Chalmers Street Consulting.
Chalmers Street.
After 16, maybe 17 years of really doing process improvement, helping different parts of the organizations that I worked for find ways to streamline their process, deliver higher quality for their customers, and really organize their employees, right, and develop their employees to do those things. I just that was my passion. I was like, this is all I'm ever going to do. I don't really want to take any other path there is in the corporate space. I just want to keep doing this. And I felt like I could do it with a bit more freedom externally and also bring it to the mid-market in a way that I don't believe anyone really has serve the mid-market specifically with those skills. And so I left my company and I founded Chalmers Street Consulting. And we've largely been doing that. We have some larger customers and some smaller customers, but our kind of main base is those mid-market companies that are trying to scale up, that are trying to grow, that want to be competitive, are hungry, and they realize that they have to find a different way to organize their work and develop their employees to be successful.
Interesting. I love hearing about the journey that people have gone on from the start to, working essentially in consulting. I'm curious if you remember back to some of like the individual jobs that you had and maybe job titles or, how you progressed to there. Because I feel like some of the insights that people who are just getting a taste of this thing that we call continuous improvement, sometimes there's a little bit of this like, where is this going to take me? Like, what kind of jobs does this touch on? So I'm curious if you might tell us a little bit about maybe some of the jobs you had along the way.
A story there, and I'm still friends with him today, but our plant manager, kind of early, like my second job inside of Motorola, he was offering me a little bit of a different path. And I was a black belt. I'd earned my black belt and I wanted to keep doing transformative projects. That's what I wanted. And he's like, yeah, they get you a lot of visibility. You know, they're engaging and they're different. I understand why you do that. But Matt, if you stay on this path, you may get stuck in that kind of role for the rest of your life. And I thought to myself, huh, well, maybe I will, but that doesn't sound so bad to me. Like, I like this. And it is, you know, it does, you don't quite climb the corporate ladder the same way in this space, right? I don't know how else to say it. You kind of top out. You can top out a little bit, although I think that's changed too. From early on, I started as an industrial engineer, so stopwatch and clipboard, and very traditional kind of like time studies and layouts and those sorts of things. And I kept coming back to, I like this idea of improvement, and I like the idea of helping people improve. People that want it, you know, people that are like, no, I'm good with having somebody else come in, look over my shoulder a little bit, tell me what we're doing right, tell me what we're doing wrong, give me some data to work off of, and then use that to drive action, right? That, and that's the other piece that I found very important early in my career. I saw some folks that, you know, they would do some designs, but and then get promoted or move off to another role and not actually see that analysis and the design come to fruition. I always tried to stay through to the very end, because as any kind of change agent or engineer, what you imagine in your mind is going to work. And even when you have the data to back you up, and maybe even have a couple pilots to back you up, it's not going to quite work the way you thought. And that's extremely valuable learning. I just remember a simple, stupid one. Like, I redesigned a work area and we're moving everything around. And the maintenance guy goes, Matt, where's the fire extinguisher supposed to go? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, that column where you're now bumping a bench up next to has a fire extinguisher on it. And so we've got to move that. Where's that going to go? It's nowhere on the drawing. And I'm like, crap, you know, and we maximize space inside of this facility. And I had left out a component, because when I was out there measuring and everything, I was looking at the benches and the carts and the, you know, all these other things. I forgot about the dang fire extinguisher. And those little learnings help you know how important it is to pay attention to detail, and also just how to react in the moment, because some of this stuff is going to happen, and you better be ready to go, okay, right? Like, it's not the maintenance person's problem. It's my problem to go figure out, because I did the design.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think there's some good lessons in project management there. One that I always like is you gotta leave something for the thing to go wrong. Cause there's always something to go wrong, you know, make it part of the plan. And then when it comes up, you're like, oh, okay, I didn't know what it was going to be, but that was it.
Yeah. I like the, you have known unknowns and you have unknown unknowns, right? And you can kind of do your risk mitigation and come up with the known unknowns, right? You don't know how they're going to quite play out, but you know something's going to happen. It's those straight up, gosh, I didn't know, right, that this was going to occur. And you better still have a little bit of wiggle room there,
yeah,
to manage through that. And just have the integrity, frankly, to manage through that as well.
So this thing that we call continuous improvement, there's lots of different ways that this shows up inside companies, particularly in big companies. And I'll be really interested to hear your insights on working with, as you described, the mid-market. But some people are, let's say, like lean purist, or some people are Six Sigma, and you know, you've got visual management, and you've got project management and PMO, like there's, and change management. There's so many different layers and facets of this thing that fit under this continuous improvement umbrella. I'm curious if you have like a perspective on it, or like a way of describing this thing that you do, maybe to some of your clients or just somebody that you're telling what you do at an event or party.
Yeah. Well, you know, the simple answer is I work with companies that are trying to grow and scale to streamline so they don't have to just straight up add a whole bunch of labor or disappoint their clients, their customers. But that's kind of broad, right? I think you're looking for something more specific and maybe a little technical. And, you know, I look at continuous improvement as a framework for me to look at the business system and understand what's missing, right, from the business system. I do look at it as a problems-focused discipline. I always talk about things in terms of problems or opportunities, right? But I tend to frame everything as a problem because I'm going to look at that company's business system, right? And there's lots of different ways you can organize a business system, but I can look at them all through this framework of how have you established roles and responsibilities? What, you know, is it clear who is supposed to do what? How have you organized teams? I look at organizations as teams of teams, right? Different levels of teams. Like human beings, we're really good in groups of like 10, but once you start to get to groups of 100, you get a little bit of factions and so on. So how are you managing those teams such that they're governing themselves, they have feedback mechanisms around them, they can self-improve? And then how do you manage your workflow, right? And that's all the more mechanics of things. Like, do I have procedures written? Do I have accurate tracking of the material in and out of inventory and WIP and to finished goods? Do I capture data on the quality of my processes? And then if I'm doing that, how do I use it as a feedback mechanism? What do I use to identify problems, right? Back to problems, such that I can do solving and do process improvement, right? And so I look in those places, roles and responsibilities, governance, flow, review, and then ongoing process improvement. Like I look to see how many process improvement projects do you do in a given month, quarter, year, you know, and how many different people are you engaging in those things? Are you doing it on a continuous basis, right? That's the whole idea. So that's my approach. And I can look at any organization that way. I can look at manufacturers. I can look at IT service providers. I can look at financial service providers, call centers, you name it. I can use that same framework and on any size
Yeah, one of the terms that I'm fond of is this idea of structured problem solving. It sounds to me like you've got a formula that you like to apply for structured problem solving. I know sometimes people will have discussions of like DMAIC versus PDCA versus other methods. Do you have a particular methodology that you're fond of for your structured problem solving?
Yeah, I learned DMAIC. And so that's always my go-to. Like I learned that straight out of school. Like I learned DMAIC and I'm like, this is perfect. It organizes all of my tools. And so that's my go-to. But I would say, I would say actually particularly working in the mid-market that I find PDCA very powerful. And here's the why on that. I talked about this in one of our CI Mastermind sessions just very recently, right? Because they were asking me, what's the difference between these two? And like you're saying, there's more than just those two, but I think those are the workhorses. And I think PDCA is good because of that iterative, see, try, reflect, standardize, or try again, right? And you go back and you do that multiple times until you get to your ultimate improvement. And then we teach to do that inside of an A3. If you're not familiar, you know, it's like a big sheet of paper and you put that flow of plan, do, check, act, you know, on that sheet of paper so you can kind of see how it all comes together. But there's an iterative nature to it. And typically it's a little more focused on the doing and checking. Uh-huh. Or at least that's where the most learning comes from. Whereas DMAIC, define, measure, analyze, improve, control, there's a lot of emphasis on the define and measure, a ton of it. And I look at it as more traditional operations research, right? I'm going to spend more time establishing measurement system, gauging whether that measurement system is telling me reality, organizing the data in different visual ways to try and understand it. I'm probably going to spend just as much time in the Gemba as I might do in PDCA, but I'm going to spend a lot more time collecting and understanding data. So that define, measure, analyze, I'm going to spend a lot of time in. And then I should be educated enough at that point to go and improve and be pretty confident on my solutions and then go into control. So to me, it's the front end that's kind of different between those two. And I think of DMAIC as having a heavier emphasis on traditional operations research methods to gain a deep understanding of cause and effect.
Definitely. The X's and the Y's.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Yeah, that's exactly
so,
right.
I'm curious. So you use the word Gemba, which I'm a big fan of. And one thing that I think is interesting about this discipline, continuous improvement lean is a lot of times lean and Toyota production system, people think of this as a manufacturing system, but it's relevant to so many other industries. I know you've had some exposure to other industries. Maybe there's some examples of time, you know, like the Gemba. What does the Gemba look like if you're not in a factory with an assembly line? What are some of these other industries where going to the Gemba might mean something a little different than, you know, just standing in a factory floor?
No, it's tough. It's tough. So I spent 6 years, and this is while I was still in the corporate world, working for a company at the time. It was called Navtech, and they made digital maps, and they still make digital maps today. And the Gemba was three places. It was in the software development, the software engineers coding. That was a Gemba. It was what we called our production centers, where we took video data from the field and we input it into a huge geographic database. Really cool stuff. And then it was in the field. It was in 130 countries, maybe 140 countries, where we had geographers driving, collecting video data, gathering local maps, annotating them, and so on. So those were our three Gembas. I guess maybe the easiest one to describe, the production center, that's a matter of doing some screen reportings and observing how people are using the tool and interacting with different tools that they need, interacting with the data, interacting with the file structure to see where some of the challenges in coding that data, where the challenges existed. The field was a bit harder, mostly because it was just expensive, right? Like, I had a small team and we could get on planes and go out and work with folks in the field offices, but you couldn't do it every week, right? You couldn't do it as much as you wanted. So guess what? You're going to use more interviewing techniques and you're not going to get into the Gemba quite as much. And so that Gemba time is super valuable. But same thing, we'd get in the car, do ride-alongs. We would look at some of the output too that they would have. So, you know, they would capture notes and things like that in the field. And so we'd look at those things too to understand their processes and how they interacted with the production centers. And then on the software side, you know, we were, or they are, an agile company. I assume you're familiar with like agile methodology that's used in software development. And so we didn't spend as much time there, but we did participate like in their release train. Some of the structures that agile has, they would invite us to, because we typically brought a lot of tools that were useful in that agile space. And so that was kind of our closest to getting to the Gemba. And so if you're in a call center, is getting into the call center, sitting next to an agent, listening, like we've done a lot of that, like where you listen, you get an earpiece and you listen into the calls. We did financial services. And again, sitting next to somebody and watching them do their work, having them send you video and screenshots of what they're doing. There's always ways to do it. You have to think a little bit about it. You have to be creative to find those ways, but there's always ways to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like the screen capture in the video. I think a lot of work nowadays is done on screens and computers. And so,
well, yeah. We've even found too, we'll set up cameras. We've used security footage. So I do like, you know, I've been doing this long enough that I can admit that I would go out and stand behind somebody with a stopwatch. And we still do that today for sure. But there are other ways to collect that data. And what's nice is I always remember, you know, trying to quickly write down, you know, what's going on, like, what am I seeing? And you look down to right and you've already missed something when you look up again, you know, and you're like, dang it. And you're like, is this supposed to be like this? Or am I just not sure what I'm doing? And it's sort of the reality of doing observation is that when you look down to right, you're going to miss something. And so I enjoy being able to actually record and then go back and look at it again and then go back and look at it again. And you know, and so we do quite a bit of that because it's so valuable today. And I've even seen now, you know, where you can start to get, a wrist device that will record what's going on. You know, there's so much great technology now for doing observation, and we're trying to explore and research that so we're better at it. Because it is so crucial, right? That's where the work is happening. That's where the value add is occurring. Got to get to that level to do your solving.
So on this topic of identifying problems, you know, starting with good problem identification, are there some examples of maybe a client that you worked with where there was a particular problem? I'm kind of curious, like, how did they identify that problem?
Yeah. So there's probably a few different ways to answer it. And let me kind of organize. The first one is, I'm a consultant. I have a consulting company. People usually bring us symptoms. Sometimes they know that it's a symptom. Sometimes they don't. People bring us symptoms of what they're experiencing. Like, you know, a problem, a deep problem is painful. We're missing our on-time delivery and people are complaining. We're shipping defects. Those problems, I guess, are easy to identify in a way because you're at the symptom, the top level symptom level.
Symptom.
Yeah, yeah. And so then our job is to dive in and get into cause. But, maybe I don't want to say more valuable, but it's certainly equally important to recognize that mature organizations walk past problems every day.
Ooh.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. They're used to seeing them. So they become part of the wallpaper, right? They're a little piece of paint, the chip that's missing, that's just there, and nobody sees it as a problem anymore because it's always been there, right? Like, isn't that the classic line? We've always done it that way, right? It's always been there. It's always been like this. And for that, we encourage waste walks. So waste walk is where you've got the eight wastes and you got a sheet of paper with the eight wastes written on it, and you specifically look for them. Right? It's not like passive, like, oh, let me see if I see something. There's defects in your process. I guarantee it. Go find it. There's waiting in your process. I guarantee it. Go find it. Right? So the way we're wired on the practitioner side is we always assume something's messed up. Like, it's not a matter. Like, when someone says, oh yeah, no, it's running great, I'm like, nothing runs great. Come on. Be honest. So it is the formal methods. So waste walks is a big one for us that we encourage. And I would say leader standard work is another one. If you can get your supervisors to note down what they're seeing during the day, and frankly, one of their activities during, let's say, the week at least is a waste walk, you start to uncover those problems that everyone's walking past. I think the reason people walk past them is also just maybe some of those problems aren't the biggest priority right now, you know, but over time, those things build up and they become, you know, kind of a debt, an anchor holding you back from excellence. And they become a kind of like almost like a validation of mediocrity, right? Oh. It's like, well, you know, the second shift always misplaces where the drills go. So why do I care if I put it back in the right spot, right? And it's only a minute or two that I take looking for it every day. So what's the big deal, right? But when you start talking about multiple times a day and multiple days a year, and that adds up to a huge cost, an unnecessary cost in serving the clients. So you gotta have formal methods that expose and give an opportunity to provide visibility to problems. People actually have to learn how to search for them.
It sounds like you mentioned things like leader standard work and the waste walks. When you go into a new organization, I would assume that, you know, people come in all different shapes and sizes with different levels of training or you know, pre-information. What are some things that you might ask or questions to like assess someone's maturity? Like, are they doing this? Are they doing that? What are some of the things that might help you orient to where someone would be in their journey?
I always go back and forth on the value of maturity assessments. So we've done them. There's different good ones out there. I think American Manufacturing Excellence Society, something like that, have a nice maturity model. ASQ, of course, has maturity models. And so that certainly is a formal way of doing that. And we, you know, Chalmers Street does operational evaluations. But I always wonder, you know, it's not about the valuation. It's about what you want to do with it, right? So that's kind of a side, and maybe that's a little bit off tangent from the answer you're looking for, but I think it's important. So if I'm just trying to size them up, so frankly, so that I can put together what I think they need, right? That's the value of the evaluation, is put together something that they need. I'm walking the floor and looking for the involvement of their supervisors. Are they in their cubes? Or are they out working with people? I'm looking at placement of things. Is stuff marked? Are different working areas clearly defined? Are pathways defined? Is there garbage on the floor? I mean, you'd be surprised. Or maybe you wouldn't, I don't know. And I always look too, like, do people walk past it or do they pick it up? You know what I mean? And you see both. Like, I've seen great environments where everyone's always like making sure they pick up stuff. But I look for those things. And then I look for kind of part of visuals. Is there information on the floor that's useful to the employees? Certainly things like safety information, but also production information. How was our quality yesterday? Did we hit our output numbers? Are we communicating with the floor and treating them like capable problem-solving humans, or does it look like they're all kind of widgets in a big machine? Come in, don't ask me a lot of questions, and just go do your job, right? And there's no floor management, right? That would be on the poorer side, let's say, of an evaluation or a first impression on their continuous improvement.
I think that is kind of an interesting, you know, tension, you might say. Sometimes when people see like, oh, we're going to come in and we're going to improve processes and we're going to standardize and we're going to do these things, I think there's kind of a feeling that people have like, oh, they're going to start treating us like robots, when really I know and you know that like that's completely the opposite of what we're intending. But how have you seen like the way these improvements get presented, you know, sink or float based on how it's presented?
Yeah, that's, you know, whether you're doing plan, do, check, act, or define, measure, analyze, improve, control. Who's your team? Who's working with you to do the improvements? Or is it just the production leader or the plant manager on high coming down and saying, thou shalt do this, right? Like, that's a problem when someone in there has all the answers because maybe they feel like they have to. I don't know why that happens, honestly. It's a little bit of ego, but I love it when the answers come from the organization. And so that's maybe the first part of the answer to your question is you just have to engage people. Like when we go out on the floor, we talk to folks, right? It's not like I'm more introverted than extroverted. And so I don't love just walking up to somebody and talking to them. But if you're going to be in their space, it's only respectful to introduce yourself and say why you're there and then ask what stuff's going well and what's not, right? So that they have some input. Like, you know, to your point, right? Do people feel uneasy? They do if they feel like change is happening to them. If I'm out there doing something for them, that changes the dynamic. And now not everybody even likes that though. And so that's where you have to reinforce, well, guess what, folks? Like, we're a business, you're part of a team, and we all have to work together in order to serve our customer and all of us to get paychecks and eat. And if we are all working in different ways, if we aren't working in a standard way, we're going to have trouble communicating. We're going to have trouble handing our work off to the next process. It's going to be an uglier day. So that those standards that we're trying to understand and we're doing through an observation process, right? It's really to help you coordinate your work better so that your day goes better, so we serve the customer better, so the company grows and your job is more secure over time. But I think it's a real change management component, and the culture, the existing culture, will affect whether or not, you know, you're expressing that, whether they get on board immediately or they're very skeptical of you.
Makes sense. Yeah. I heard you, part of your prior answer was about leadership and how the leaders are acting and treating the organization. I've heard a lot of people express the importance of executive buy-in or leader buy-in for any sort of a change program. What advice or insights or experience might you have about the role that leaders should play versus maybe the role that you sometimes see them play and it can be challenging?
Yeah, like I said, don't have all the answers, please. You know, they got to that level because they're smart, right? And some of them got to that level because they want to have all the answers. And maybe they actually do, right? Like some leaders, man, I mean, they're so quick and they see things and they do. But I've been in places where we had to unravel a culture of deferring to leadership because I know, and this is what I'm saying is going on in that kind of leadership environment. I know that whatever I say is going to get overruled by the boss. So I'm just not going to say anything. And you know what? What's even better about that? If I don't make decisions, nobody can come back at me. I was just doing what I was told, right? And that's toxic. And yeah, it's out there. It's out there. The leaders that I enjoy and that frankly are the best clients for Chalmers Street are the ones that are pragmatic and also can decide when we've thought enough and it's time to make a decision. That balance pragmatism with, I don't know, speedy decision-making. The ones that ask questions first, those are great. The folks that have a desire to delegate down and recognize that delegating down isn't as simple as saying, hey, you're now responsible for making sure parts get to the work cell on time. It's also making sure that that person has the training and the support around them to be successful. And so delegates down, but with also while creating the environment around people so they can be successful. So, you know, people leaders that are pragmatic, I believe, do the best with a continuous improvement mindset and approach. And ultimately, I believe, are more successful at running larger organizations than the folks that are autocratic and maybe smart as a whip, but don't have the self-awareness to realize that they're starving their organization of growth, of their own personal growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of limiting the growth. That's one of the things that I find personally very interesting with this whole topic is a lot of these concepts are like super easy to like, oh, okay, yeah, I get that. That makes sense. But it's kind of like knowing that the path to a healthy lifestyle is to eat less and exercise more. Like, we all know that, but for some reason, it can be hard to follow that advice ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
I think that some of this leadership advice, like how could, let's say there's a leader out there who's like, I think of myself as a good leader, but man, I might be the person being the answer guy. Like, what could I do? Or, you know, what would you recommend that somebody might do to help shift directions?
A simple answer is ask your team. You know, for leaders that are super autocratic, they're not going to get an honest answer. Another way is to just be quiet, not say things and see what happens, right? Does someone step up? Does the meeting come to a conclusion with a decision? Or is everything getting pushed back on me, right? And is everyone being quiet and waiting for me to speak? Those would be evidence that that's going on. And then if you're going to change that, one, there's probably some coaching that's required to do that, right? Because it's sort of like, I love the phrase, you can't read the label from inside the jar.
That's a good one. Yeah.
That's right. It's like, we all have blind spots. Like, I've got people that coach me. So I'm, you know, tell me what you see. So you probably need a coach and then need to be really deliberate with the organization to let them know that this is something that we want to change. Otherwise, people don't know. People just think you're doing something different and it's weird, right? but I would say first, be quiet, see what happens when you're quiet. And then second, you know, let the organization know that we're going to change things and here's how it's going to work in the future.
Yeah, I'm interested to talk about this idea of being a consultant, because you know, in the mid-market, if you've got a consultant, you know, it's a different dynamic than if you're working inside of a company. Some of the people that we work at the KPI Fire, they might be in big companies, and they'll have like these CI departments who almost function like a consultant, or they might not be part of, let's say, that facility. Maybe they work at corporate, they come in, and there's a different dynamic as a culture. And sometimes there's a tension, you might say. It seems like you probably have some tips and tricks for how to not freak people out when you're looking over their shoulders. What advice might you have for how to approach that in a way that's not threatening?
You know, it's kind of similar to what I was saying before, just around help people know that you're there for them, not necessarily looking over their shoulder against them. There is some, so it doesn't necessarily apply exactly to your question, but there is some tension that's good. I mean, sometimes a little bit of tension can be positive. I mean, one of the things kind of back to when you're saying, what do I look for when I walk into a company to kind of gauge where they're at from a continuous improvement perspective, how are they checking work? We're all have a tendency to have our own confirmation bias, right? And believe what we're doing is great and believe we're making all the right decisions. And if you don't have checks in place, you don't ever get that feedback to know, okay? Those checks are attention, right? And there's really, the only way you make those checks less tense is, again, you let people know that we're doing this to help the process. It's not about you, right? Removing judgment, removing blame, that's where we can get the most open environment, collaborative environment for driving continuous improvement. And so that's how we can make it kind of a lesser challenge or lesser tension. But my point is that, yeah, but I still want the tension. Like, people work a little better under pressure. Like not, you know, I want to be careful. People work better under pressure, but there is a level of pressure where people cut corners and do bad things. Right. So I can't say that, you know, as a complete statement. Yeah. There's some caveats to that statement. Is what I'm trying to say. So some tension is good. Some tension is good. People knowing that we're checking and we're looking, right? That's good. Knowing that there's a feedback mechanism, and if something's not going well, it's going to pop up on a chart somewhere and someone's going to ask me about it. That's good. Knowing that we're doing those things, we're creating that tension because we're serving our customers better. We're trying to create a better, safer work environment. We're trying to beat our competition, and we want you to be a part of that. It's not about you. It's about a process. That's where you can kind of dull the edge of that tension. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. As you talk about that, the thing that comes to mind for me is the idea of metrics and, you know, measuring stuff. And this is a topic that some organizations, they know exactly what metrics they need to be measuring, and they've been measuring them for years. But more commonly, there's some new problem that's happening which might require the use of some slightly different metric, or let's just say there's a lot of data being measured and not all of it is useful. I'm curious if you might have any experiences of maybe certain measures that were in use for a long time and they were just not the right ones, or other ones that you found are really great.
You know, I probably have an example there, but I have to think about it for a while. What I see more often is a fear of establishing the measure because the information may be imperfect. And there's a good book called How to Measure Anything. And I can't remember the author, but it's a good book, How to Measure Anything. And what I really liked about it is early in my career, I was that person. Like, I'm like, hey, there's no data on this process, right? And we're not going to collect good data on the process. Okay, well, flying blind isn't a better answer to that. And in that book, he really emphasizes that any data collection is going to be valuable, right? Even if there's some flaws in it, right? You should at least know what those flaws are through your data collection, so that you can understand their impact on any decision that you may make from them. But data collection, any data collection is valuable. So that's the first thing, is just go collect some data. The second thing, and I often find myself telling this to companies after I've really pushed data-driven decision-making on them, is that, you know, Lean and Six Sigma continuous improvement is not a measure everything program. Measurement, there's a cost to it, right? There's a measure, there's a cost to taking measurements. So we should think about what's important to measure. And what I usually find is there's a small number of things, you know, yield, scrap, throughput, right? That are useful, ongoing, should always measure them, kind of measures. And then there's measures that are useful for a project purpose, but then I'm going to probably sunset at the end of the project and just use my higher level measures to make sure that whatever change I made is staying in place. You know, maybe don't approach measurement as a silver bullet. That's probably the first thing to say. But don't be afraid, right, that just because the measurement isn't perfect that we're doing. And we find ourselves setting up simple spreadsheets, putting tablets out on the production floor so that companies can start collecting measures. Well, guess what? When we do that, people forget to put data in, they fat finger it, whatever. Those things happen. But I've never had the case where it wasn't useful. Like, we still go, okay, well, this is useful. And then you start using the data. Maybe this is the other point. You start using the data, and then it becomes more important to everybody for that data to be good. And you start reinforcing it. So it starts to become this virtuous cycle of, I get better at measuring, I start using it more, I get better at measuring, I start using it more, I'm solving more problems, and I'm more aware of what's going on. Because, you know, again, back to that, I can't read the label. I can't read the label from inside the jar. That measurement is external. It's telling me reality. I might hate it. I might love it. I don't know. But it's just, it's unemotional. It's just right there. And I can start my problem solving with clarity when I have it.
I like that. I think, and we're touching on another topic that I'm pretty fond of, but The value in touching the numbers in some way. I'm curious if you find for the people solving the problem, you know, sometimes you've got numbers that are just up on a digital board, whereas there's some numbers, like you said, you know, you're fat fingering them. I wonder if you have any words of wisdom on the value of touching the data versus just having it reported, you know, up there.
Oh, man. Do we have another hour? So one story is I rolled out Gemba boards. This is long ago, Gemba boards, and they're all paper and people would go get their number and they would write the number up and then they would hold their Gemba meeting. And one of our technologists came through and he's like, "What are you doing? This is ridiculous. This could all be digitized. We could put it on a board." I'm like, "You could, but you've now separated people from the information. Like, you put this degree of like buffer between me and what happened. Like, I want people to feel it, like color it in, like show me." So and I say all that. And I also admit that at times or in with some of our clients, we do use, you know, generated reports and slap it up on the wall because it makes sense. But I do like, you know, physically putting a number up there because you really feel it. I don't know. It's like different, like it's human. We're physical beings. Right. So
yeah.
But then the other point that I think you're making is we do a lot of data mining from big data warehouses and stuff like that, and Power BI and all those things are great tools. But you don't know a lot about those data points, right? They're collected at a time and place when, you know, at least the folks that are doing the analysis weren't around, versus when you are physically capturing each one of those numbers yourself, you know exactly what's going on. You know that there was a power outage. I don't know. You know that the machine jammed. You know that, you know, all these things because you're there seeing it real time and collecting the data, and you can make a note about it. And I've had debates with clients that, you know, large data sets, large sample sizes aren't necessarily better than small sample sizes collected by an engineer who's watching the physical process because they have full context of what's going on in the moment and can then take that and turn it into problem solving. Whereas with big data sets, I'm just guessing and I'm looking for groupings, right? It's useful. It's useful, but I'm not convinced that those small data sets aren't possibly more useful.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, particularly coming from like the software world. There's like this bias that digital technology can solve everything. But I agree with you there. I would describe it as value add work. There's actually some value add in touching the numbers sometimes.
Yes.
Where it's like an ownership, or it just, you know, things click a little bit differently when you're responsible to it. There's, you know, various studies and whatnot on that. So that's, you're right. That probably is a topic that we could go into in a lot deeper ways. Well, let me try to summarize some of these maybe lessons. Is there some lesson that you feel like you've learned in your, you know, X decades that if you could maybe do things differently or learn that sooner that you might like to pass on to the younger version of yourself?
Yeah. I think there's maybe two. One is that it's not going to work exactly how you have it in your mind. I'll see if I get this quote right. It's an economic quote. It's the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they know about what they dream they can create. That was Friedrich Hayek. That exists in engineering and continuous improvement. Like, we can dream big. You were mentioning kind of like, oh, you know, you're just going to press the AI button and the Tesla robot's going to come out. And okay, I that world is coming. But like with most technology advances, it's going to come in little bits at a time. We're going to go, ooh, that actually made things worse. It doesn't that grand design that you have on paper, the process map and the technology that you just purchased, it's not going to do exactly what you had in your mind. So be ready to change and react, be adaptable. And then as maybe a little bit of a continuation of that, when I change a process and hand it back to the process owner, I can't assume that that process owner, and depending on the degree to which they were involved, they better be involved, but still, like, the degree to which they were involved in the change, they may not be ready to just jump in and do it. Like, don't underestimate the amount of training. I'll never forget, we moved a distribution center within the same region, right? But it was still a move. So a lot of the same employees. And fired things up on go live day, and things got stuck, I think, in the packaging area. And someone went out there, it wasn't me, but someone went out there and they're like, what's going on? Why is everything getting stuck here? And they're like, I can't find the packing sheets that we use to, you know what goes where. And they're like, they're in the printer. And the person's like, what printer? It's right over there. It's the same printer we had at the other place. Yeah, but at the other place, the printer was over here. It's a small change, but you know, we all get into our routines. We all get into our routines. So don't assume that everyone's going to be able to take on and run that process the way you have in your mind. And that component of building good supervision, training, practices, habits, discipline, it's absolutely crucial to the whatever the process change is, maybe equal to whatever the process change is, because if it doesn't get adapted, if it doesn't get executed, it wasn't worth the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. This is an off-script question, but is there any like games or models or anything that you like to use as part of your training to teach people some of these lessons?
So all of our training, so we do training that has exercises in it. And exercises are useful, so you can check like how are people doing five whys. All of our training, our CI Mastermind program is real projects live in the Gemba. Like we do all that training through real stuff. I also teach for Northern Illinois University's Lean Six Sigma program. And this we didn't invent, we borrowed from some other place, I don't even know where, but there's an airplane building game. You build airplanes, and you build a production line, and you assemble your airplanes. It's just a really good way for people to see handoffs and decision making and batching and all those kinds of things. But you can invent a lot of them. There's a lot of good exercises like that you can go find. Companies have off the internet. We do paper helicopters too, to teach design of experiments.
Cool.
That's through NIU as well. So there's quite a few out there. I don't know that I have a passion for anyone. I would say where my passion lies is real, you know, live environment application. That's where I believe the greatest learning occurs. And you know, you stumble a little bit, but those stumbles are an important part of the learning journey.
Well, let me ask you, if folks want to follow up or follow you or get in contact with you, what would be the best way for them to follow up with you?
So look at me on LinkedIn, Matthew R. Kroll. Look at my website, www.chalmersstreet.com. There's a SST at the end there. So chalmersstreet.com. And you can see some of our offerings and some testimonials of our stuff too. And sign up for our newsletter. And we also run a monthly CI Mastermind live session where we try and create a little bit of a CI Mastermind environment, but we do it for free. And we try to solve problems real time in that environment. So frankly, there's lots of ways. There's lots of ways. Any one of those are great ways to get to know us and what we do.
Yeah. And I, as somebody who sat in on one of those masterminds just this week, I thought it was great, really excellent way to just talk to different practitioners in different areas. I learned some new things. I think probably most people there did. So I think that's a great service that you offer, that mastermind. And you've got a newsletter that's great. So I would encourage people to follow you on that. And yeah, really appreciate you joining us today and sharing some wisdom. I'm sure we could do this again in a few months and probably have a whole bunch of stuff to chat about. This is a great topic. I really enjoy talking to people who are as passionate about this as you are. So thank you so much.
I love doing it, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thanks, Keith.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire. KPI Fire is continuous improvement software. KPI Fire helps you align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people all in one powerful software platform. So whether you're leading a team or transforming an entire organization, KPI Fire is your partner in achieving breakthrough results. Learn more at kpifire.com. And for anybody listening, if you'd like to suggest a guest, ask a question, or give us any ideas for future episodes, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, Keith C. Norris. Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. So if you've enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like and follow us and share us on all the socials. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.